The subject that I'm addressing first off this afternoon is called Evolution, the Religion of the Atheist. Obviously, I deliberately chose to label it in that particular way because the evolutionists always present their view on origins as being scientific, while creation science is regarded as unscientific or pseudo-scientific and just religious hocus-pocus. But what I want to bring to your attention this afternoon is mostly quotations by evolutionists themselves, which will show you that in fact evolutionary teaching, belief, is not scientific at all. It is belief in something that's unprovable and has certainly not, and the evidence that we do find in the fossil record and in genetics and so on, prove anything such. In fact, the fossil record and DNA supports the creation model. Now, it doesn't prove it. We rely on the Bible for the proof of creation, because the only one who was there was the one who inspired holy men to write down the record of how life began, how the world began, and so on. Now, why address this subject at a meeting like this? Because it has captured the minds of the public at large. Children are indoctrinated in this subject in the schools. And some of you may or may not know that Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, has banned creation science being taught in the schools alongside evolutionary science, so-called. And he has obviously swallowed the lie of the evolutionists that their particular system is scientific while creation science is not. They are going to begin this indoctrination at primary stage. Their books will be full of dinosaurs with millions of years attached to them. And this is the process of indoctrination, which then goes on, if they should go up at the university level, into their 20s. Now, materialistic evolution is the religion of the atheist. What do I mean by that? Materialistic evolution means that there was no God, no supreme intelligence involved. The universe began with a big bang, that's the present popular theory, and somehow or other, along the way, life began, and I shall come back to that in due course. Now, before I go any further, we need to define what evolution is. That is, particles to people, molecules to man, evolution. One simple explanation is this: the descent of all life from a common ancestor by undirected mutation and natural selection. No intelligence involved. It was something that happened by chance, so that we here today are the result of a cosmic chance, if you like. It's rather like some gambling odds. that we are here. It's just chance. There's no reason for us being here. There's no purpose to us being here. It is the result of undirected mutation. Professor Dawkins, well known to most of you, has stated that evolution has made atheism intellectually respectable. There were atheists, of course, before evolution came along, but they've latched on to evolution as something that gives them credence for their belief that there is no God of any sort or description, that the world is purely the result of materialistic forces at work in a haphazard and purely chance way. There is something else that we need to be aware of, for when we speak with evolutionists, because they call something evolution that's not evolution at all, and if you don't understand this, you may get confused. There is what we call macroevolution, that's the molecules to man variety, but also microevolution. And microevolution is not evolution at all. That's the term they use when referring to variation and adaptation in existing kinds of birds, human beings even, animals. As we look around this room, as I look around this room, I see variation. Some of you may be adapted to sitting in the cold, while other of you may like a warm, stiflingly hot room, just as a simple example. Some of you are tall, some of you are short, some of you are strong, some of you are not so strong. That's just the built-in variation. Nothing to do with evolutionary processes, which is changing from one kind into another kind. If we should say, for instance, monkeys becoming men, or as is now the fashion, we're descended from a common ancestor. I often say in the open air, don't insult the monkeys, but that's, they don't behave as badly as human beings, that's for sure. But they'll use this, you see, to say, you don't believe in evolution. Well, look at all the variation there is. Look at all the different species there are. But you see, that's not, I say, evolution at all. And they use an example, you've probably heard of it, the peppered moss example, which I have read in books, is one of the strongest examples of evolution in action. Now, what is this peppered moss scenario that they present? Well, there are two types of peppered moths, the dark-colored ones and the light-colored ones. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the white were in predominance because the black ones, supposedly resting on tree trunks, which incidentally they don't, are more visible to predators. Therefore, the preponderance of black and white meant it was 80% white to something like 20% black. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution and everything become blackened by the smoke, the situation was reversed. The whites now became more visible, or the light-colored ones, and the dark-colored ones were camouflaged. Therefore, the percentage proportion between the one and the other changed. I don't know the exact figures. That's not important. Just the fact that now there were more of the dark-colored ones than there were before. And so they said, there you are, there's evolution in action. Well, it's nothing of the sort, and it's so obviously nothing of the sort, because what we began with were moths. Dark-colored moths, light-colored moths. We'd say it was an 80-20 split. And at the end of it all, what did we end up with? Dark-colored moths, light-colored moths. Something like, we say, a 60-40 split. You see, nothing had changed as to the makeup and structure of these moths. It was only the fact that the environment favored the one over the other. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the light-colored. In the post or in the Industrial Revolution, the dark-colored. Evolution teaches there's a change in the genetic structure of living things, so that as millions of years go on, they become entirely different to what they set out as originally. So mice might really become men. Anything can happen. But you see how they use this to confuse people's minds. Because people don't think today, really. And they say, well, look at those creationists. There's an example right before our eyes of evolution. And they don't believe in it. But I hope you can see that that itself is not evolution whatsoever. And in fact, the photographs of these moths and tree trunks was a fraud. They were actually stuck on there, because apparently they don't normally alight on tree trunks. But you can see, even if they don't, if they alighted on other surfaces, that you could get that change only in the numbers, but not in the actual structure of the moths themselves. And this, they say, is one of the strongest evidence for evolution. And I repeat, it is not evolution at all. In fact, evolution doesn't happen at all. Now, the one thing they are adamant about, they will not allow anything divine or any intelligence to come into the debate, or indeed to their whole concept of evolution. Richard Lewontin, a geneticist, leading evolutionary biologist and a Marxist, wrote as follows. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its construct, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its many extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. This is an evolutionist writing. Because we have a prior commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute. We cannot allow a divine foot in the door. There you have it, straight from the evolutionist's mouth. He's saying it doesn't matter how ridiculous it may seem, how ridiculous the concepts, the fact that they don't make sense. There is no way, because we have a prior commitment, that's what I priori means, a prior commitment to materialism. Therefore, they will not allow, under any circumstances, the concept even of any supreme intelligence, any intelligence at all, of involved in the creation of the world and even evolution itself. Now, how did life begin? Now, we know how it began because the Bible tells us so. But the evolutionist doesn't know. And they actually admit it. It's not often they admit ignorance on anything. I saw an interview with Richard Dawkins. How did life begin? He says, we don't know. He says, nobody knows. Perhaps it began in outer space. panspermia, that's called. Another individual said perhaps began by molecules piggybacking on the back of crystals. Evolutionists do not know how it began. Nobody knows. But we Christians know, because the Bible, as I say, tells us so. So they actually acknowledge they don't know how life could begin. George Ward, in The Origin of Life, Scientific American, 1954, stated, spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. When it comes to the origin of life, there are only two possibilities, creation or spontaneous generation. There is no third way. Spontaneous generation was disproved 100 years ago, but that leads us to only one other conclusion. We choose to believe the impossible. That of supernatural creation we cannot accept on philosophical grounds. Therefore, we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. But on his own admission, it's impossible. Now there again you have the mindset of the evolutionist. He acknowledges it's impossible. The only other possible explanation is creation. But he says, on philosophical grounds, we reject that and we believe the impossible instead. At least I applaud him for his honesty. In The New Scientist, 17th of January 2009, talking about gaps in how our knowledge of life began, it says, the first genetic material might have been RNA, but equally, it might have been some other unknown molecule. And which of Earth's varied environments was the one that first spawned life? Did it appear in a deep hydrothermal vent, on frigid polar ice, or in boiling cauldrons of clay and water? We just don't know. So by their own admission, they don't know how life began. And as George Ward said, it is impossible that it began by chance, but we still believe it because we will not acknowledge there is a creator. Now, the fossil record, according to the evolutionists, the fossil record extends back hundreds of millions of years. We, of course, don't believe that, but they do. And if evolution was true, then the fossil record would have within it literally tens of thousands of missing links, i.e. transitional fossils. As organisms evolved, then we would see that taking place. It would be preserved in the fossil record. But that is not the case. As I've written here, according to the evolutionists, the fossil layers were laid down gradually over millions of years. The lowest fossil-bearing layer is called the Cambrian layer. Below that, there is virtually nothing. All fossils in that layer appear fully formed. In fact, they call it the Cambrian explosion. Because below it, there's virtually nothing. Then all of a sudden, in this layer, which is the bottom fossil-bearing layer, usually, there's a sudden explosion of fully formed life. And it says that they all appear fully formed without any evidence of descent from other less developed creatures. In fact, this is what is found in all fossil layers. In other words, there are no transitional fossils, more commonly called missing links. In spite of the sensational reports appearing in the media from time to time, there is not one transitional fossil that all evolutionists agree on. Not one. There should be tens of thousands. Now, this is a leaflet I have. I have some of them on the table there free, that I often use in the open air. I'd only quote three of evolutionists speaking on different aspects of steps in evolution. Now, listen carefully to it. Invertebrates to fish. All three subdivisions of the bony fishes first appear in the fossil record at approximately the same time. Why is there no trace of earlier intermediate forms? That was a man called Gerald Todd, American zoologist, evolutionist. The second one, the very first fishes undoubtedly arose from invertebrate protochordates. However, the first fishes left no fossil record, and their form and relationships are a mystery. Well, this then begs the question, why do they believe that fish descended from these invertebrates, since there is no evidence whatsoever to support it? It's because they believe it to be so. Evolutionists are not evolutionists because of the evidence. They are evolutionists because they have a belief system, a prior belief system, and they are seeking for evidence in the fossil record and in the genetic code and so on. But here they're acknowledging, we believe this happened, but we have absolutely no evidence that it did happen. So how do they know it happened, is the question. Now, I'll only use one other. This is apes to humans. Dr. Richard Leakey, very well-known evolutionist, in a PBS documentary in 1990, he said, "If pressed about man's ancestry, I would have to unequivocally say that all we have is a huge question mark. To date, there has been nothing found to truthfully purport as a transitional species to man. If further pressed, I would have to state that there is more evidence to suggest an abrupt arrival of man rather than a gradual process of evolving." That says it all. You see, the evidence for creation is there in the fossil record, for all fossils in the fossil record appear fully formed. And many of those creatures found in the fossil record are found today virtually unchanged, or not changed at all. And that after supposedly millions of years. Now, these are quite astounding acknowledgments and confessions indeed. Yet, they are evolutionists. The proof is not there. Ernest Mayr, very famous evolutionist in America, he wrote a book, published 2001, What Evolution Is. Given the fact of evolution, wouldn't one expect a gradual change from ancestral forms to descendants? But this is not what the paleontologist finds. These are the fellows that study the rocks. Instead, he or she finds gaps in just about every phyletic series. Professor Carl Sagan, I think that's the correct pronunciation, he is very popular in television radio shows in America. He was an astrophysicist, an astronomer, a cosmologist. Higher level phylogenetics is hot. Unprecedented funding opportunities, increasingly sophisticated phylogenetic methods, and an accelerating avalanche of data have combined to make new phylogenies welcome fodder for our revered scientific tabloids. One thing that the phylogenetic forest has brought into sharp relief is that never before have we been faced with such conspicuous gaps between the body plans of closest relatives. The missing links are still missing. Dr. Donald Jenner, in a publicity material for his lecture, Please Mind the Gaps, Fact and Fantasy in the Reconstruction of Body Plans, wrote this. Barring fortuitous discoveries from the fossil record, many or most of the gaps can be expected to become permanent with our imagination as the only available bridge across these gaps. It seems inescapable that our scenarios of body plan evolution will forever remain poised on the narrow edge between fact and fantasy. I suggest to you it's mostly fantasy with very few facts. Now, the evolutionists used to say, you see, that the fossil record was the greatest proof for evolution. This was before genetics became proper science. Now, they are saying that is not so. And the reason they are saying that is because there is no evidence for evolution in the fossil record. So here is a statement by zoologist from Oxford University, Mark Ridley. No real evolutionist, whether gradualist or punctuationist, uses the fossil record as evidence in favor of the theory of evolution over special creation. They've changed their tune somewhat over the past 50 or 60 years. Now, that punctuationist refers to a theory put forward by Harvard University professor of paleontology, the late professor indeed, Stephen Jay Gould, another Marxist, who said that because there isn't any evidence, or he said few evidences, of transitional fossils in the fossil record, evolution must have happened so quickly that there wasn't time for it to be recorded. Now, when he says quickly, he's talking about millions of years rather than hundreds of millions of years. And he invented the theory of punctuated equilibrium. Highfalutin sounding name. What he says is that evolution happened in quick spurts so that there wasn't time for the evidence to be fossilized. That's a just-so story, all right, isn't it? It's also known as the hopeful monster theory. I won't go into that. The late Colin Paterson, who was senior paleontologist at the London Museum of Natural History, wrote a book in 1980. When he was asked why he had not included any examples of transitional fossils in his book, he replied, "I fully agree with your comments about the lack of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any fossil or living, I would have included them. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument." I wish to tell that to the BBC. In a public lecture, same man, in New York's Museum of Natural History on the 5th of November 1981, he said, "One morning I woke up and it struck me that I've been working on this stuff, that's evolution, for 20 years. And there was not one thing I knew about it. This was quite a shock that one could be misled for so long. I tried putting the question to various people and groups of people. Can you tell me anything about evolution? Any one thing that is true? I tried it on the geology staff in the Field Museum of Natural History," I think that's in Chicago, it's in New York, sorry, "and the only answer I got was silence. I tried it on the members of the evolutionary morphology seminar in the University of Chicago, And all I got was silence for a long time. And then one person eventually said, "Yes, I know one thing. It ought not to be taught in high school." That's from this late common person. Now afterwards, oh, he denied it. You see, these things were said behind closed doors, you see. But when it gets in the public, oh, we were misquoted, we were misunderstood. Nothing of the sort. He's just embarrassed by the fact that it got out. The late Stephen Jay Gould, who I've mentioned already, said this: "The extreme rarity of transitional forms, I would say the complete absence, in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology." I remember listening to Gary Parker, he's an American, used to be an evolutionary teacher in high school, if not university, who was at a lecture while he was still an evolutionist, and they were told about the absence of evidence and so on, and this is what the lecture said: keep the faith. Keep the faith, i.e. the faith of evolution, which I am seeking to prove to you today. The evidence against evolution is staring them in the face. But rather than admit that the superior intelligence was involved, they come up with increasingly idiotic suggestions. This is a case of willful ignorance, as Peter in his epistle terms it, which is why I had that read out. Now, we are told that evolution is scientific. By the way, as Christians, we are not against true science. We would be against unethical true science, such as experimentation with embryos and so on. But true science, barring that, we would not be against. Of course not. Some of the greatest scientists in our history were creationists. I don't know about their actual standing before God, but Lord Kelvin, for instance, Faraday, Newton, and others. But I'm just going to lay before you what the scientific method is. You ask a question, or you pose a hypothesis. Then you do background research. You construct your hypothesis, you test your hypotheses by doing experiments, you analyze your data and draw a conclusion and communicate your results. But this you cannot do with evolution. Because, you see, in the past, in the fossil record, as I've already said, there is no evidence. And if you ask them where it's happening today, well, they say, well, it's happening too slowly. You can't see it happening. So we can't see it from the past, and we can't see it in the present. But it still happens, according to them. But that's a belief, not the result of scientific experimentation. Observation. Now, in that definition of evolution which I give you, it says that it's the descent of all life from a common ancestor by undirected mutations. Mutations are supposedly the driving force of evolution. But what are mutations? They are actually faults in the genetic code. Now, of course, we as creationists believe that God made us with our full genetic potential, in perfect working order. But ever since the fall, faults have been occurring in the genetic information of all creatures. And some of these faults don't cause much damage. Some of them are catastrophic, depending on where they occur. But mutations are of this order: they transpose information, it's in the wrong order, they duplicate it, and the real serious mutations actually lose genetic information. For an organism to evolve from simple to complex, What must happen is that mutations need to increase the genetic information in an organism so that it goes from simple to complex, and it enables that organism to survive more efficiently than its other organisms who haven't got this mutation. There has never been observed one mutation that has added information to the genome. The genome is just the sum total of genetic information of an organism. If you can imagine a computer program, because I think that's a good analogy, and you see, in a computer program, it's the programmer who controls whatever information's in there. Obviously, there's a limit depending on the electronic memory, etc., that's and bits and pieces that are in there. But a good programmer, he can make alterations, he can make it a better program by tapping the keys. Don't ask me how, but anyway, they can. But this is not what happens, because you see, God's program was perfect for everything. You didn't need to add anything to it. God doesn't have to modify. I often say when I was in the Air Force, I used to work on V-bombers, amongst other things, we were always carrying out modifications as we found things didn't work as well as they should, and these modifications were put in to improve it. But God made everything good, perfect, very good. And mutations are faults in that perfect program. And in fact, the loss of genetic information causes the organism to devolve, not evolve. It becomes less suitable to survive. So right there, mutation being the driving force, it's driving the organism to destruction, not to becoming a better, more complicated, more able to survive organism than before. It's the very opposite. And that's, to me, evolution's dead in the water there, right there, because they say evolution is the driving force. Mathematically, that three mutations should occur that would be beneficial one to another, i.e. each one occurring, would actually help the organism along life's pathway, is in the order of 28, one to followed by 28 nothings, which of course is in the realms mathematically impossibility. That's just three mutations. But in order for an organism to evolve to the multiplicity of life we have today, you're talking about millions of mutations. And even with millions of years, there wouldn't be enough time for that to occur. As a matter of fact, human beings are becoming loaded with more and more mutations, which we have been finding more and more hereditary diseases. Quite the contrary. So mutations are faults in an existing program, if you like. They are not something that adds to the complexity of the organism. Now, some loss of genetic information in some instances can be beneficial. For instance, the cormorants on the Galapagos Islands have lost the ability to fly. But because the Galapagos Islands are very windy, it's actually a benefit to them. Those who can fly, of course, flow back to the mainland. But those cormorants would not normally survive in competition with the, in a normal environment with the normal cormorants, because obviously they're much less efficient. And then in the matter, for instance, of bacteria, germs that are resistant to antibiotics, it's not that they've evolved that resistance, they've actually lost genetic information. The receptors that take in the antibiotics are missing. But these bugs were already in existence. when they tested some of the foodstuffs left by Shackleton in the Antarctic, you know, they found them frozen deeply after many years, they found these resistant bugs there. You see, they existed all along, but they were so few in number, it didn't really matter. They couldn't compete with their fellow bugs, if you like. And doctors will tell you one of the best ways to get rid of antibiotic resistance is to stop giving antibiotics for a period of time to allow the normal germs to recuperate so that these resistant ones will become just a minority again. But it's in very few, but in each case, they've lost information. But in normal circumstances, their ability to survive and compete with the ones who are normal would be seriously disadvantaged. Now, natural selection. Natural selection does happen. But it's not an intelligent force at work. It's simply this, that the less fit survive. That's all it is. If, like I was brought up on a farm and you had a litter of pigs, bonhams, piglets, and you had the runt, well, you might as well kill the runt because he wouldn't survive, because of the normal ones would make sure he got nothing to drink or eat. And it's the same with animal husbandry. You would not allow those with genetic faults in them to carry on because they simply wouldn't thrive, and in any case you wouldn't want them to pass on that fault to succeeding generations. So natural selection preserves the fit. But the fit are those who God made fit in the first instance. You see, the evolutionist has the mindset we began as single-celled amoeba or whatever, and over the millions of years we became ever more complex and fit to survive. But the biblical truth is that we were created perfect in the first instance, as I've said, and over the years we are deteriorating. But what natural selection does, i.e. where something is born less fit, it removes it. But the evolutionist sees it as something that's more fit. And natural selection then will remove the others who have not had this mutation from the equation. Because in the evolutionist mind, the mutation has increased the viability of the organism that has it. But of course, as I've told you, it doesn't happen that way. It's the very opposite. So in fact, natural selection tends to keep the norm and remove the faulty, which is caused by mutations. Now, I'll close with some statements again by evolutionists. Leading anti-creationist philosopher Michael Ruse said this: evolution is promoted by its practitioners as more than mere science. Evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a fully fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality. This was true of evolution at the beginning, and it is true of evolution today. That again is a pretty profound statement. Mark Sigham, Teaching and Propaganda, printed in June 2000. Students trust their professors, and I use that trust to brainwash them. Our teaching methods are primarily those of propaganda. We appeal without demonstration to evidence that supports our position. We only introduce evidence that supports the currently accepted theories and omit or gloss over evidence to the contrary. I am convinced that the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in the school classroom by teachers who correctly perceive their role as the proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity. These teachers must embody the same selfless dedication as the most rabid fundamentalist preachers, for they will be ministers of another sort, utilizing a classroom instead of a pulpit to convey humanistic values in whatever subject they teach. Well, there you have it. And if you send your children to the state school, that's what's happening to them. And under Gove's instructions, even more so, and at an earlier age. Richard Dawkins, when speaking of the God of the Bible, I'm just going to quote this to you, to show you the hatred in the heart of men like Richard Dawkins for the God of truth. This is what he said in his book, The God Delusion. He described the God of the Old Testament in the following terms. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Notice fiction. He is jealous and proud of it, an unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, dysfunctional, genocidal, megalomaniac, sadomasochist, capriciously malevolent bully. Can you imagine something more horrible than that? But he is the ear of the public by and large. He has certainly got the ear of the BBC and other media. But that reveals his heart. And he is actually saying, of course, what multitudes think. Now, in closing, I often, that's why I brought these with you, because I use these in the open air.
Amen.
I meet with, you know, I thought I'd be inundated with people calling me ignoramuses and stupid and all the rest of it when I started with this. There's very few people who take me on, much to my disappointment. But some do, and they say they had sort of a nominal Christian background. But when they went to college or university and heard about evolution, they became atheists. The week before last, unusually, I had about an hour and a half conversation with a young man. Nice young man. He wasn't abusive, because normally they're just abusive. They just go past and hurl abuse at you because they have no argument, you see. But this young man, he said he had been baptized. I don't know. I suspect he was a Romanist myself. But it doesn't really matter in the event what I'm going to say. But he said when he learned about evolution, he became an atheist. So you see, this is why it's so important that we seek to speak to young people, to show to them that evolution has no scientific basis whatsoever. It is a belief system. Evolutionists are not evolutionists because of that they were constrained to be so by what they observed, i.e. in the scientific method, or by experiments they've carried out. They are evolutionists before ever they look for the proof. A priori. That is how they start out. It is not, as we see here, it is not that as they look in the fossil record, as they look at genetics and so on, that it's obviously that evolution is true. Nothing of the sort. And as I've often said, it is because they don't want the idea of a God to whom they are answerable for their behavior. And I have spoken with people at work, and you can just see the shutters come down. You know who I'm talking about. And when you present them with the evidence, they will not have it. They'll try and talk over it, they'll try and dodge it, and you can see it right there. But nevertheless, we need to counter it, because it is making, destroying countless lives. And let me tell you something. It is this that is at the root of what's happening in our society today. The abandonment of Christian morality, replacing it with atheistic immorality. That is why we have widespread promiscuity, perversion, and abortion, and increasing euthanasia. And I tell you this, pedophilia down the line, for there is no depth of depravity to which the humankind cannot go if God does not intervene. And so I would say to you, I'm not a scientist, but I'm able to hold my own with them. And as I say, don't be afraid. Get the basic facts. Don't be afraid to take them on. Because I tell you, I do this. I said, I've no doubt if I asked you to hold up your hands how many believe in evolution, most of you would. Now I said, could you give me a definition of it? And I sort of paused. Anybody give me a definition? No. I said, so you're believing in something, you don't know even how to define it. And then can you give me any proof of it? I'm hoping people will take me on. They don't. As I say, the odd one goes past ranting and raving, and very occasionally you get a good conversation. But we need, friends, to be on the streets or every opportunity we have to counter this religion. For a religion it is. It is not scientific at all. How good it is to turn to the Word of God. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and all of it was very good. Amen.